cricket, declared the subject of today's edition of Great Lives, along with the classics, is the most important thing in life. A character, as we'll come to hear, all but cut from the pages of ripping yarns, the stuff of empire and of legend, of upper-crust patrician bearing, who's cast a long, long shadow across the outfield ever since. No cricketer myself, I find this tale absolutely gripping. Douglas Jardine, England's cricket captain during the infamous 1932 Bodyline Tour of Australia, turned sport into a diplomatic incident, tainting it with the sulphurous whiff of unsportsmanlike behaviour. He's been chosen by a familiar Radio 4 voice, the broadcaster Peter White, who we hear each week presenting You and Yours and In Touch. The BBC's disability affairs correspondent for the last 15 years, Peter was the first totally blind person to produce reports for television news. And last year, Peter, you won Radio 4's Comic Relief stand-up competition with a guest slot on The Now Show. But what persuaded you to choose, well, let's raise the temperature here, a cad as your great life?
Well, you see, I would question the use of the word cad straight away. Someone guilty of or capable of ungentlemanly conduct. And I just don't regard what Jardine did, which is getting people to bowl very fast at big Australians with great lumps of wood in their hand, as ungentlemanly. I chose him because cricket is one of those things, and it's strange, that blind people tend to identify with very strongly. Of all the games, it's got so many textures to it. You know, it's got all the sounds, and it's human chess, and it's got all these elements which are not just visual. And I suspect that's why people find it exciting and thought-provoking to follow.
And why it works so well on radio.
Well, that's right. Yeah, see, I started to follow cricket on radio. There were 2 years, 1954, when my brother wouldn't play with me all through the summer holidays because he was listening to cricket, and 1955, when I decided that if you couldn't beat them, you better join them, and got absolutely fascinated by cricket and followed it. And of course, cricket coverage, about which, of course, many people complain on Radio 4, but it is wall to wall and it's ball by ball. So you really can, as a blind man, you can follow cricket in huge detail.
We will perhaps take up the argument later as to whether bodyline bowling is just bowling very fast. But let me ask you first, when you first encountered Jardine as a cricketer?
I was at a boarding school for blind children. It was a grim place, I have to say. It's now been closed and I'm very glad of it. It was a boarding school where the prefects, rather like Winchester, where Jardine went to school, it was a school where the prefects held sway. And when I was about eight and in a dormitory, it was ruled over with a rod of iron, but a rather unsteady rod of iron, by this 15-year-old boy.
Who was blind too.
Who was blind as well, and who basically knew how to get what he wanted from you. But the fact of the matter was that I was very lucky in that I had certain elements with which I could fight back. But the one thing, Braille is something which not many people, including blind people, read very well. And I did read it quite well. And so he used to get me to read to him from Braille books after lights out. And this was something that protected me from his worst excesses, because he would be inclined to slap you about a bit for things that you'd done wrong. And he would then talk to me. Amongst the things he talked to me about was cricket. And this bodyline series, which had taken place, I suppose, we are in the 50s, so it was about 20 years earlier, but it seemed in the far reaches of history. And he told me about this and how we had beaten the Australians. He tended to talk about Larwood, of course, who was the fast bowler who would excite an eight-year-old. But I was more interested in this guy Jardine, who had made it all happen and seemed to be pulling all the strings in this human chess.
You've used that word chess twice, which obviously from the point of view of a blind person, one can see how that's translating the game into a set of spatial moves. I want first to bring in our expert on Douglas Jardine, who is, as it happens, another familiar Radio 4 voice. Christopher Douglas co-writes and performs Ed Reardon's Week, the grumpy 50-something failed writer who feels that life and success have unaccountably eluded him. Chris, you wrote your biography of Jardine after dramatising the Bodyline Tour as a radio play. Given how strongly Jardine divides people, even to this day, was he a saint or a sinner, do you think?
Well, as you say, he provoked contrasting reactions, as great leaders tend to do. He was loved, hated, admired, envied, pitied, sometimes all at the same time. In fact, if you read the letters home from some of the players who were on tour with him, it's very striking how quickly their opinions of him changed. And I suppose that's often the case with great leaders. I think Douglas Jardine possibly represented the legendary British qualities, well, perhaps the mythical British qualities of iron resolve, calmness under pressure, physical, moral courage. If you're English, that is. If you're Australian, he probably represents the legendary British qualities of stuck-up, toffee-nosed, downright pommy arrogance. But oddly enough, when he visited Australia 20 years after the events which made him famous, the Bodyline Tour, he was received with great warmth and friendliness, so he was quite an enigma.
Beside Ed Reardon, another of your creations is the failed cricketer Dave Podmore. Let's just listen to how you spoofed the Bodyline controversy in a recent episode.
Fast rewind to 1932 and the infamous Strictly Bodyline Tour of Australia, where some of the English dancing tactics were branded unfair by the home side.
England's cricketers caused a sensation at the Adelaide Palais de Danse when, halfway through the quick step, the Nottinghamshire speedster Harold Larwood tripped up the Australian captain, reacquainting him with the parquet floor.
There are two teams out there and only one of them's ballroom dancing. Like Gallipoli all over again. I'd say it's pretty ordinary.
The Aussies may have thought it was unsporting, but the England skipper Douglas Jardine was unrepentant.
Our tactics have been successful, and I hope the broken leg theory will bring about a similar result at Brisbane.
Bad luck, you cobbers, but don't blame us if your feet can't keep that crazy beat.
From Strictly Dave Podmore to Strictly Douglas Jardine. Chris, let me put you on the spot here. Given how controversial Jardine both was and is, and the enormous anger that he aroused, justify him as a great life.
When I wrote his biography 25 years ago, I was able to talk to quite a few people who had known him, got as close to him as anyone ever did. And all of them, even those who didn't like him much, used the word great. Mm. I've got a treasured letter from Harold Larwood, the finest of all England bowlers, and the letter ends with the words, "Truly, Mr. Jardine was a great man." So although he divided opinion, I think it's fairly clear that he was universally admired and respected. I'd say he was a great man. Perhaps great life is not quite right, because in some ways it was unfulfilled. After he retired, he never really found a role that was worthy of his gifts.
But that's partly, isn't it, Chris, because he was outlawed and blackballed and ignored, because he would have surely found that life probably in cricket.
Quite possibly, yes. Mm. Yeah.
It is you, Peter, who've nominated him as a great life, and yet both of you seem to be suggesting that it was a life that could have been great but went sort of wrong.
Well, I would have to accept that there is one moment in history where he stands at the centre of events, and you could argue that that therefore makes it difficult to justify it as a great life, if by that you mean, you know, all sorts of fulfilling events going over the whole of that lifetime. I think what I would want to say about this is that Jardine was in many ways betrayed.
Let's pause it there, Peter. Let's hear a clip of the man himself. This is Douglas Jardine talking in 1933 after the Bodyline controversy and after taking his team to Australia.
A definition of cricket, which has always struck me as being the only worthy definition of cricket. It was described as this by a New Zealander when he said it was their beautiful, beautiful game that is battle and service and sport and art.
How accents change. That beautiful, beautiful game that Jardine arguably did something to tarnish. What do you hear in that voice, Peter? For me, it's very telling. Clipped, shy, yeah. Posh, a voice of its time.
It's quite interesting because I live in Winchester, where the great public school is. That's another link. And actually, it's quite moving for me because I'd never heard my hero speak before. So that is a telling experience.
Is it what you expected?
Yes, I think in a way it was, because I knew he was clipped. I knew he was shy. What you don't hear there is any sense of the humour of the man, because he was a very funny man. I was thinking when listening to the Dave Podmore clip that Jardine, but actually far from finding that offensive, would probably have found it very funny. His daughters tell of Jardine towards the end of his life rolling in laughter at the Goon Show. Now, that is not the picture of Jardine that we've been painting so far. So I think he was a man locked into himself.
We can shed a bit of light on that voice and that accent. Douglas Jardine was born in 1900 in Bombay, sent back to Britain for prep school, followed by Winchester, as you say, and Oxford. But very much, Chris, a child of empire, wasn't he?
Yes, he was born in 1900, as you say, and so he was only a Victorian by a matter of a few months, but in many ways he was more of a 19th century than a 20th century man. Had a pretty austere childhood, as you say, went to Winchester, Oxford, and so he had pretty much the perfect CV for the job of England captaincy. When he was made England captain, he brought a kind of thoroughness and professionalism to the job. So in some ways he was ahead of his time, but you could equally well say that he was 100 years behind it as well.
Well, that's what I find so puzzling, Chris, that there does seem to be a complete paradox here, in that you've got Jardine, and there he was talking about the beauty of the game and service and so forth, and yet it was him who turned it into an entirely professional game. But he was an amateur at a time when there was real sort of tension between the idea of amateur and professional. The idea that there might be a professional captain one day, for example, one who was paid, for goodness sake, was horrific. And yet that's exactly what Jardine was, wasn't it? He was, although he wasn't paid, he was the first professional captain.
Yes, he was in favour of professional captains.
Because you get the feeling that he actually got on better with the likes of Larwood the Miner and Bowes and some of the others than he did with the toffee-nosed ones he was supposed to get on with.
I wanted to ask you about that, Peter, because Winchester, in a sense, links you, because you live there, and he was at Winchester College. But in other respects, your class backgrounds are very different. What was yours?
Mine's a working-class one. People don't believe there are any working classes in Winchester, but they're wrong. I grew up on a council estate. My dad was a carpenter. My mum washed up at the local training college, skewed by going away to school. So I think I'm a bit mixed up and a bit messed up as well, because I had a working class background. But after I went to my second school, which meant passing an 11 plus, the blind children from all over England came together with a complete mix up of classes. So I've got, I suspect, a bit of that Jardine thing in me, in the sense that I have a mixture of my working class background, but also nostalgia, in a way, for the time of what Jardine represents.
But what did a boy from a working class background in Winchester think of Winchester School and the young toffs who went there?
Oh, we didn't like them. No, we didn't like them at all. Probably we still don't. If they stray into the wrong pubs, which they do from time to time, there's always a bit of frostiness. You know, it's classic town and gown.
He looked so aristocratic. And he was almost like a sort of caricature of an English aristocrat. He was sort of tall, thin, hooked nose, walked rather stiffly around the field. And he used to bat, not in his England cap, but wearing this thing called a harlequin cap, which is a multicoloured cap.
Which really wound up the Australians.
Yes, and when he first went
sort of camped it up then, didn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. And thoroughly enjoyed that. When he first went to Australia in 1928-29, the crowds targeted him immediately because of his appearance. And to begin with, he rather enjoyed winding them up, but then his form fell off, and he then took to regarding them with sort of cold indifference, with predictable consequences. It just made things worse.
Did his arrogance or his provocativeness show itself early? Did it show itself at school, for instance?
There were certainly people who spotted it. Indeed, when his old cricket master heard that they were going to make Jardine captain of England, he said, well, you know, he's either going to be a fantastic success or he's going to lose us a dominion. And, of course, that's what almost happened. It was an extraordinarily prophetic thing to say.
We might win the Ashes, but we might lose the dominion.
That's exactly what he said, yes.
You're listening to Great Lives with me, Matthew Paris, and my guests Peter White and Christopher Douglas, discussing the controversial English cricketer Douglas Jardine. Chris, before we ask you to explain precisely what Bodyline was, we need to understand the extreme threat posed by Don Bradman. He, without fail, each and every match, he was notching up the most extraordinary scores, and something had to be done about him. Is that right?
That's right. Statistically, he was almost twice as good as anyone else who's ever played. He scored 100 every third time he went out to bat. He had an average of 99.94, which is an iconic number in Australia. And it's about 40 runs ahead of the next person on the all-time great list. So he was a huge problem for anyone playing against him. He was quite a problem if you were trying to make your way as an Australian batsman as well. And he actually drove one of them to drink. But if you were going to play against him, you really did need to have a plan.
To that plan, then. Now, instead of asking the expert to explain, why don't I, who knows nothing about cricket, try to say what I think Bodyline is, and you tell me, Chris, if I'm right. Basically, it's let's eschew expert terms like bowling. It's throwing the ball at the head or chest of the batsman rather than trying to hit the wicket. Is that right? So confusing the batsman that the ball is then easily caught off his bat.
It's a combination of trying to intimidate the batsman and frustrating him into playing a rash shot. And if you're facing a bodyline delivery, it's coming at you between 90 and 100 miles an hour at your upper body, and you've got three choices. You can either jump out of the way if you're quick enough, if you don't mind losing your dignity, or you can just stand there and let it hit you, obviously very painful, or you can try and whack it with your bat. But you haven't got much control over the shot because of the height of the ball, and there's only one place you can hit it, which is into this double semicircle of cunningly placed fielders. This is the bodyline field. So it's very difficult to score any runs and very easy to get yourself out. The component parts of it, the fast bowling, the bouncers, the leg side field, had all been around for years, but they hadn't really been brought together with such intensity before. But because Harold Larwood, the English bowler, was so fast, he turned what was a very dull defensive tactic into something that was a lethal form of attack.
And Larwood completely refused to apologise for it afterwards.
That's
so Jardine wasn't the only one. Larwood could have easily said, "I was only obeying orders, Gov," but he never said that.
No, it's also worth pointing out that it was entirely within the laws of the game at the time.
Surely, Peter, though, a blind man feels especially vulnerable to things flying at very high speed at his head from directions that he doesn't know. How can you feel anything but horrified by the whole idea of...
You mean I ought to have empathy for the Australians?
Yes.
Well, I don't think someone who's a real cricket fan, who's an English cricket fan, can't have empathy for Australian cricketers. It's a contradiction in terms, Matthew, and indicates your ignorance of not only the game, but the whole culture, or lack of it, involved in it. Maybe you have made, though, a rather telling point, because perhaps it's because I do know that I'll never have to face these balls being hurled at my head. I think actually it is rather an interesting thing, is it? Because one experiences cricket through radio, through it almost being told to you as a story, you could make quite a subtle point here about how realistic my perceptions of what it's really like are. It's more, I think, Jardine's character in refusing to back down under enormous pressure, because he was under pressure from the crowds, he was under pressure from quite a lot of not his team but the managers, who were a lily-livered lot, who, you know, knew what was going on, and then when the going got a bit tough, refused to back him, some journalists. So he was under fire from everybody and refused to back down. I think that's what appeals to me.
You can understand how those pressures arose, though. One of those occasions, a fast bodyline ball hitting an Australian cricketer, was followed by a characteristic example of Jardine's tact and diplomacy. As the stadium fell quiet after Woodfall had just been hit by the ball, Jardine's clipped voice rang out, "Well bowled, Harold." I mean, that's provocative. Let's just hear about that incident from the point of view of one of the Australian team, Jack Fingleton.
The number of us had been hit. The feeling was very intense. And Billy Woodfall had been hit a very nasty blow over the heart by Harold Larwood. Now, to be hit by any fast bowler over the heart is not a very pleasant experience. But a chap as fast as Harold Larwood, it was a sickening thud of a blow. And everybody felt sick for Woodfall. But Douglas, who was so relentless in his outlook and things, he meant to win this test series, immediately ordered a stronger leg side field, which incensed everybody. And I think that was about the height of this unpleasant series in Australia. But don't let's dwell too long on these things, Rex. That was a very, very good English side.
Well, we are dwelling on these things. The veteran Australian cricket commentator Alan McGilvray called Jardine the most notorious Englishman since Jack the Ripper. It all turned into a full diplomatic incident.
That's right, but once the Australians had sent a cable calling the Englishman unsportsmanlike, the whole situation changed, and the sympathy shifted from the Australians, who were getting battered by it, to the English, who had now been maligned. So there was an instant flurry of diplomatic activity. It reunited the England team, and obviously they felt unable to continue with the series unless the charge was withdrawn. Various viscounts and earls in England were woken up in the middle of the night, and the Secretary of State for War, Lord Hailsham, who was the president-elect of MCC, had a word with the Secretary for the Dominions, J.H. Thomas, who then had a word with the acting governor of South Australia.
It was all being played out in Whitehall.
Yes, yeah. Well, of course, there were connections between cricket and Whitehall in those days.
There are. That it got to the cabinet, isn't it? I don't think...
It doesn't appear in the cabinet minutes, but we kind of know that it happened. And eventually, the Australians had to back down, and the charge of unsportsmanlike was withdrawn, and the series continued in an atmosphere of simmering resentment. I mean, once Bodyline was seen on English soil in 1933, after he came back as conquering hero, it was pretty clear that its days were numbered, because it was not an edifying spectacle. It was one of those things, it was quite exciting initially to look at, because it had a kind of brutality about it, but after a while it just looked awful.
So for a man who changed the way people approached the game, and as you said, Chris, was in some ways an anachronism reverting back, but in some ways rather ahead of his time, and who brought the Ashes home, why did he just drop out in the rather sad sort of way? He went back to being a bank clerk and a travelling salesman.
He got married, for one thing.
Yes, he had four children.
He had family responsibilities.
Four children to support.
Yes.
He didn't really find a role that was worthy of his abilities. But he became quite an accomplished writer. He reported on cricket for various newspapers, the Star and the Telegraph, even wrote short stories and did a bit of commentary. But it was surprising that he didn't rise to a position of eminence that you might have expected.
And he didn't even have a very eventful war either, which
about that.
Yeah, I know that I did as well. I wanted to ask Chris about that because, you know, it seems that he ended up in India but not doing anything particularly significant. That's possibly not fair, but you know what I mean. Mm. You'd have expected somebody like Jardine to be commanding a platoon of men, making a last stand somewhere.
I think from talking to the people who served with him, possibly the problem was that he cared a bit too much about the welfare of those men under him.
That does sound a bit odd, given what we've been saying.
I know.
But it's an attempt to knock people's heads off.
That's what they say. I mean, he was injured at Dunkirk, and he disappeared behind enemy lines to try and track down some people who got cut off, found them all dead, and then commandeered a truck and drove back through enemy lines. So it wasn't completely uneventful, but yes, I know what you mean. You would have expected him to do something a bit more than what he ended up doing in India.
You've made your career, Chris, specialising in skewering the foibles of failed and self-deluding characters, and this is a life, Jardine's life, that is curiously braided success and failure, but a sense of failure about it as well as success. Does that interest you? Is that what has drawn you to him?
Yeah, I think I'm drawn to characters who think the rest of the world think as they do, and there's something quite funny about that. And the more out of step they get, the more interesting and hopefully the funnier they become. Jardine was absolutely not one of the lads, you know. I can't find a shred of evidence that he ever took part in a team fancy dress contest or fell out of a pedalo or dressed up as Diana Ross or threw his trouser press out of the window. And that makes him unique, really, as an England cricketer. So,
but you see, I'm not sure I agree with you there, Chris, that he thought that people felt as he did, because I think in that sense he did have a bit of a kind of a sense of superiority. I mean, that's why he was so offended by the Australian crowds, because he felt that he had absolutely nothing in common with them whatsoever.
He was very rude about Australians.
They were very rude about him. I mean, and there were more of them than there were of him. So I think he felt a bit outnumbered by all of that. I'm drawn to him in a way for the reverse reason, that I think I'm one of those people, who kind of likes to get on with people and will to some extent go with the flow. Seems to me that Jardine, once he'd made up his mind to do something, because he thought he was right, there was no sense of backing down whatsoever. And I quite admire that, even though I think that probably led to that slightly unfulfilled element in the latter part of his life. But I admire him for it.
I was touched to read that Jardine's daughter, Fiona Laurie, recalls him as being cloaked in sadness in the later years of his life. He was never angry, she said, about the furore surrounding Bodyline. But yes, there was this distinct air of sadness. Father believed that when the going got really difficult, the MCC made him the fall guy. Mm. Is that fair, Chris?
They didn't sack him, he resigned. But I think perhaps there were attempts to airbrush him out. He was rehabilitated, and his portrait still hangs in the long room beneath Bradman, which is perhaps appropriate. So next time the Australians come to play at Lord's, they'll see his cool gaze looking at them from the wall as they go onto the field.
Would you say, Peter, looking back on the whole life of this man whom you've rather stoutly defended as having lived a great life, is there any advice you would have given him to do anything differently?
I think I would have advised him to let that humour that everybody who knew him well agrees he had, I would have advised him to have let that humour come through. I think that had the Australians got even a hint of that, it wouldn't have been quite such a poisonous relationship. I think he was so buttoned up, because I've read about it in more detail in the last few days, and you think, oh, for goodness sake, Douglas, you probably are right, but, you know,
Loosen up
a bit, mate, yeah.
My thanks to Peter White and to Chris Douglas. Well, Douglas Jardine died of cancer in 1958. Amongst the many tributes paid to him came this one from Sir Pelham Plum Warner, chairman of the England Selectors in 1932. If ever there was a cricket match between England and the rest of the world, and the fate of England depended upon its result, I would pick Jardine as captain every time. Goodbye.
I have to say, that's pretty rich coming from Pelham Warner, because Warner initially backed Jardine. Indeed, he claimed that Jardine got to the captaincy on his shoulders. And then, when the going got tough, Warner was nowhere to be seen.
He backed him publicly, and then as soon as the series was over, he couldn't wait to distance himself from the tactics.
Well, he did seem to be a bit of a man who hunted with the hounds and ran with the hare.
Well, perhaps he just felt a bit guilty about having ratted on Jardine and was trying to say something nice about him after his death.
Well, 26 years later, yes.
Yeah, but there would have been some chuckles. I don't know whether he made that speech in public or whether that was just a piece he wrote, but if he'd made it at any kind of cricketing event, there would have been quite a lot of laughter, I would think.